This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The government laid out its case yesterday against Bruce Ivins, the Army scientist they say sent envelopes of anthrax through the mail in 2001 and killed five people. Last week, Bruce Ivins committed suicide. As a result, the government's case will never be tested at trial. Based on the material released yesterday, there is a lot of circumstantial evidence, but no smoking gun. And many questions remain about the investigation, the evidence, motive, and about a man who juggled at birthday parties and played music every Sunday in church, who apparently described himself as paranoid, delusional at times, and very, very angry. Today we hope to answer some of your questions and lay out what we know and what we don't. Later in the program, Murray Horowitz joins us with the start of our summer movie festival, wedding movies this week. But first, if you'd like to know more about the evidence and the investigation of Bruce Ivins, our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. With us here in Studio 3A is NPR science correspondent David Kestenbaum, who's been covering this story since 2001. And David, many thanks for being with us today.
Sure. Hi, Neil.
And let's start with the weapon. What do we know about the anthrax?
Well, the FBI referred to the anthrax. They said, well, you know, we do sort of have a murder weapon here, but you know, it's sort of a weird murder weapon because guns don't reproduce themselves, right? And spores do. So they, Bruce Ivins was the custodian of a flask of spores that they say has the same genetic characteristics as the ones used in the attacks.
How specific is that information?
Well, they also they say that they gathered over 1,000 samples of anthrax from labs all around the country and probably the world, and that when they did this genetic comparison, the spores used in the attacks only matched 8 of them, and they said the parent sample from which these the 7 other ones came from was the one that Bruce Ivins had custody of. Now, that's not to say necessarily that his That means it matches 8. Is my reading of that is that means it matches 8. And the FBI has not told us where the other 7 samples were, what labs they were at, or how many people would have had access to those.
But they did say that the people who had access to that flask of Bruce Ivins' anthrax, that everybody else checked out. Everybody else had an alibi except for Bruce Ivins.
That would have been a fairly limited number of people who had access to his flask. But again, the other flasks, my understanding, would have been could have equally well have been the stuff used to make the spores that were sent through the mail. So they certainly he was, he had access to spores that matched the ones used in the letters, but it's unclear how large the pool of people was that would have had access to equivalent spores.
So he had opportunity. Others may have had it too, but he did.
He did. I mean, this is not. If we go back to Stephen Hatfill,
that was the scientist who was also suspect earlier in this investigation.
Right. Stephen Hatfill said adamantly, "Look, I've never even worked with anthrax. You know, why are you looking at me?" Now, he had commissioned a report to look at the effects of anthrax sent through the mail, and there were other things like that. But Bruce Ivins, by contrast, did a lot of work with anthrax since the 80s. He's published something like 40 papers, and by my count, all but one of the last ones were about anthrax. And he was an expert in making it and learning how to make it. And there's some question about whether he had all the tools. The FBI says he had all the tools.
We want to get listeners in on this conversation. If you'd like to know more about the evidence against Bruce Ivins, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Rob is on the line. Rob calling us from Sioux Falls in South Dakota.
How are you guys?
All right.
Good.
Say, I saw on the press conference that the FBI had yesterday that they presented some sort of a machine that they felt Ivins used to convert the liquid anthrax that was in the flask to the weaponized form of it that was in the powder. But I saw Gerald Posner was on Keith Olbermann's show last night. He said that he talked to several microbiologists that said that this machine was not capable of converting the liquid weaponized form that was used on these attacks. Do you have any more information about...
David, as I understand it, you need two machines, one to dry the wet anthrax spores and the other to mill it.
Right. So the device would be a lyophilizer, which is basically like a freeze dryer, and it is something where you could take wet protein or wet anthrax and then dry it. But then you would need to make it into a powder, and that especially the powder in the Dashlin Leahy letters was described as being very fine, very uniform. And so to get that, you would need to then mill the dried bacteria, the dried spores. And you need to do it carefully so you don't crush them. I mean, that's sort of a tricky part of the process. So the thinking from a lot of people who know about these things is that you would need some a device to mill the dried anthrax. And so far, in none of these documents do they talk about where that would have been done or how that would have been done.
But they did say there was a freeze dryer that Bruce Ivins had access
to. There was, and I've talked to a colleague of Bruce Ivins who said, yes, we had one. It was out in the hall. You know, we used it periodically. It's not unusual to use it when you're doing vaccine-type research. It's a way to dry things for storage.
Rob, thanks for the question. Now, we're talking about the weapons themselves. What about the targets and the motive? What do they say about the motive that Bruce Ivins would have had?
What the FBI offers up as a possible motive is that Bruce Ivins was under a lot of pressure at the time and working on some problems with a vaccine, with an anthrax vaccine. And they have some emails showing that he's frustrated about that. But the emails, when you read them, they're not they don't seem so over the top. And when I talk to other colleagues who were working on that stuff at the time, they say, yes, it was an issue, but it wasn't the sort of thing that was driving anyone insane. The FBI also, points to his history of mental illness at the time. And around the time of the attacks, they have emails of him talking about feeling paranoid and delusional.
But everybody knows mental illness, that's not a motive in and of itself for a crime.
Right. I mean, if your delusion is that someone is out to get you and then you want to take revenge on that person, that can create a motive. But mental illness on its own is not a motive.
And what about the targets? Why, out of all the possible places he could have mailed them, would he have mailed them to those to the news media outlets with the first batch and then to two specific Democratic senators?
Investigators say he was prolific in writing sort of letters to the editor and to politicians. Dashiell and Leahy, there was an article listing them as sort of bad Catholics for not being pro-life or not enough. And they've traced some money that he and his wife gave to one of those organizations. And as to the media, he wrote letters to the editor of the local paper. That was clearly something he thought about.
There is also the question of where he mailed them from, and that was identified as a post office, one of those corner mailboxes on Nassau Street in Princeton, New Jersey. But as far as I read in this affidavit that they presented yesterday, they cannot put him in Princeton, New Jersey on that day.
Right.
Those 2 days.
That's right. They have. There's no discussion of what his alibi was on those days, where he says or thinks he was on those dates, and they have nothing saying, nothing from a toll booth or gas purchased in Princeton, New Jersey, or anything like that, indicating showing that he was there.
Let's go to Mark, and Mark's on the line with us from Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I realize that handwriting analysis is kind of iffy, but the anthrax letters were hand printed. And theoretically, Ivins would have documents with his handwriting on it. Has anybody in all of this going after Ivins matched up any of his existing handwriting, known handwriting, with the anthrax lettering?
The investigators were asked about that at the press conference, and they said that since it was pretty clear whoever sent the letters was trying to disguise their handwriting, they didn't think much could be learned from that. That was their answer.
That the Justice Department and then the government and the FBI says that handwriting analysis would be inconclusive in this case.
Right.
Well, how did this guy, if he has a history of mental derangement, end up in a high security clearance?
Well, I can tell you, having talked to a lot of his colleagues who've worked with him, going back, some of them over a decade, that they are all shocked and still shocked and, that he would be a suspect in this. And so these people say they saw none of that. I mean, Bruce Ivins clearly talked about some of this stuff in emails to people and was going through a lot of anguish at various times. But it was not something that people who interacted with him on a daily basis tell us they remember.
And he still had his high security clearance even after he was under investigation by the FBI for terrorism?
We do, and I would encourage you to look back at some of the stories we've done about that. There's actually criticism that the security clearance process takes too long, and it relies on people self-declaring some things. They do sign away their rights to so that people can look into their health records. But again, you'd have to know where to look to find the psychiatrist the person was seeing. I mean, I suppose you could look at insurance records, but it would be an enormous amount of work for people looking into security clearances to do that for all the thousands and thousands of people who have it within the U.S. government.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Mark. And let's see if we can get another caller in. This is John. John with us from Spartanburg in South Carolina.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to make a point about it took the FBI 7 years to close in on this man. It seems that there would be a narrow group of people who would have access to the anthrax. And in my mind, it's just crazy how it would take 7 years to close in on this man.
There were a small number of people at this lab, but if you ask the question they were asking after the attacks in 2001, which was how many people had access to the Ames strain of anthrax, because that's all they really knew about it, that was a much larger number, because that had been shared around to, I don't remember, over a dozen labs. Because anthrax was just something people did research on. You could get it from a cow you get it from the dirt in a field. So,
and what changed was there is a new kind of test that could identify the particular strain.
What helped things along was that, the science, these machines to do the sequencing improved, and people studied anthrax, they learned more about the genetic sequence. And over the years, that gave them a more precise way to tell which samples in labs matched the stuff in the letters.
But with the weight of the whole U.S. government behind the FBI at that point, with all the resources they could have used worldwide resources at that point, it should have been the nation's top priority besides catching Osama bin Laden. It just seems that we could have come to a conclusion a little quicker.
Well, I think they are going to hear some of those questions being posed by our next guest, Rush Holt, a congressman from New Jersey, who's going to join us after we come back from a short break. But, John, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking with Congressman Holt and taking more of your calls about the government's 7-year investigation into the anthrax killings. Yesterday, the government laid out its case against a government scientist by the name of Bruce Ivins. We're trying to tell you what we know and what we don't. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Here's some of what we know about the man the FBI says is solely responsible for the 2001 anthrax attacks. Bruce Ivins worked as a civilian at a military laboratory in Fort Detrick in Maryland. He held a degree in microbiology and is reportedly listed as co-inventor of 2 patents for a genetically engineered anthrax vaccine. In 2003, he was awarded the Decoration of Exceptional Civilian Service for his work, the highest honor given to non-military employees at the Defense Department. Ivins was 62 when he committed suicide last week, before the case could go to trial. You can find out more about who he was and about the government's case against him at npr.org. NPR science correspondent David Kestenbaum is here in Studio 3A walking us through the background of the case, and he's been covering this story since 2001. If you want to find out more about Bruce Ivins, give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Joining us now is Representative Rush Holt, a Democrat of New Jersey. He chairs the House Select Intelligence Oversight Panel. Several of the anthrax letters are believed to have been sent from a post box in his district, and he joins us on the phone from his district office in West Windsor, New Jersey. And thanks very much for being with us, Congressman.
It's good to be with you, Neil. I like the way you examine questions.
You've been a skeptic of this investigation for some time now. As you listen to the material released yesterday, are you convinced that the FBI has their man?
Well, the short answer is, probably, but that's not good enough. In courts, the kind of circumstantial evidence they presented, I would guess, would not hold up. But in any case, the people of Central New Jersey, whom I represent, would like to have closure, which is not just saying, well, the FBI asserting case is closed, but rather a good sense that there's no longer a murderer at large. And the FBI is, at this stage, is still asserting that there's no accomplice, that Ivins did it alone. They're just asserting that he was in Princeton and they're just asserting that an apparently fairly unstable psychological profile means that he's murderous. So there's more to produce. So you understand, you mentioned the mailboxes, or mailbox at least, was in my district. Also, post office workers who got sick were in central New Jersey. The sorting facility is just outside my district. Hundreds of people in my district, we presume, were exposed but didn't get sick. And of the four House of Representatives offices that were contaminated, one of them was mine. So I've watched this from the very beginning. And part of my skepticism comes from seeing how the FBI actually collected evidence, and it did not inspire confidence. It was sloppy. Your caller a while ago said, why did it take 7 years? Just to give an indication of how things were done in a pretty loose manner, they knew the letters were at the Hamilton sorting facility because people there got sick. It was contaminated with anthrax. In a matter of a few days, they could have traced back every path that might have carried a letter into the Hamilton sorting facility. They didn't get around to doing that till 9 months later, and they found a post box contaminated, a mailbox, a drop box, on Nassau Street in Princeton, 9 months or more than that later. And then they started asking passersby if they remembered seeing anybody that looked like Stephen Hatfield the previous fall near that mailbox. So, there were just so many things like that that made me question this whole process from the beginning.
Well, this what we saw yesterday was an affidavit put forward in for a search warrant. Presumably, there's more evidence that the government has that we haven't seen yet. Do you know more than we do?
The director called me yesterday, and partly because he knows, or I think largely because he knows that I've had this strong interest, and I've been, I guess you'd say, a thorn in their side, because they've kept Congress in the dark mostly for years now on this subject. The only documented bioterrorist attack on the United States, Congress really should be involved in oversight to make sure that we're prepared for bioterrorist attacks. And so he called me. There was nothing in his briefing to me that I haven't seen in the papers. He did agree to provide more information, and I hope we'll do this partly in the form of congressional hearings. And I told him there'd be two categories of questions I'd have. One category dealing with the specifics of this case, because there are a lot of questions, as you've been hearing and saying just now. And then there's another category of questions that has to do with the policy and preparedness. What is the role of an investigative agency like the FBI to tamp down erroneous information that inflames public fears, such as took place in the weeks after the anthrax mailings, when people suggested this was an international terrorist conspiracy. The FBI early on decided it wasn't, but
they didn't tell us.
They allowed those fears to fester.
You mentioned hearings. When are those hearings going to be held?
I'm talking with other members of Congress to see if maybe we should do these jointly, because this straddles a number of different agencies. I hope soon, but of course, to the extent that we're looking at evidence in this case, the FBI says they're still dotting I's and crossing T's, and
Until they officially close it, they're going to say it's an open investigation. We can't talk to you.
That's what they will say. Also, they may be getting new evidence still. Because this has short-circuited the usual American process where a defendant can rebut charges against him in court, and this has been short-circuited by the death of the suspect and now these press disclosures by the FBI, we'll have to find some other way, and congressional hearing might be part of it, something more than just the court of public opinion to bring a fair closure to this.
And here's another question regarding security clearances that a lot of people have. An email from Martin in Mountain View, California. How did someone with a significant psychological problem get a job in a biological warfare plant? It seems to me that is a very dangerous situation.
It is indeed. You discussed a few moments ago the problems with security clearances and how hard it is to get them done at all, let alone have them re-examined on a ongoing, frequent basis. But it seems to me we probably need to. And the problem is even worse now because when these letters were sent, there were, you know, maybe a dozen or so labs where this kind of anthrax might have come from. They fairly soon zeroed in on the Fort Detrick lab. But now, in the name of Homeland Security, there are many more investigators. And there are somewhat tighter controls, but it's mostly just accounting, reporting that the labs exist and making sure they have locks on the doors rather than real security measures, which might also include psychological observation or reporting.
Well, another thing, as you know, Dr. Ivan's lawyer says his client was innocent and that, in fact, it was the pressure of the FBI investigation and some questionable techniques that may have driven him to kill himself. Are you going to look into that, too?
I'm not sure that it's possible for Congress to look into that, but what you point out is that is a plausible explanation for what occurred also. And so, I mean, that's the trouble with circumstantial evidence. If they can't actually put the perpetrator at Princeton, and if they can't show that it's his handwriting, and they can't show his fingerprints on the envelopes, and that, you know, he was one of 100 or more people who might have done it, and they have pretty good reasons to think the other 99 or didn't do it, well, that's not, I think, good enough for the post office workers and the people who were exposed in central New Jersey to feel a sense of closure and to know that there's not a murderer still at large.
David Kestenbaum?
I just had a quick question. Are you comfortable with the FBI closing this case?
Well, not on the basis of what I've seen. Now, there's more. I guess there's more to be unsealed, maybe even before they formally close the case. The circumstantial evidence they present can't be ignored. I'm not trying to minimize it. I'm just trying to say that, you know, it's not what you would call physical evidence, the kind of thing that you would hope to have to win a court case. So I think they should stay at it. You know, they're very sure they have the right guy. But, of course, they were very sure they had the right guy in Hatfield. They were very sure they had the right guy in the Atlanta Olympic bombing. They were very sure they had the right guy with the Portland, Oregon lawyer Brendan Mayfield when they were connecting him to the Madrid train bombing. So, you know, there's a certain amount of history here that the FBI has to overcome.
Congressman Holt, we thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Rush Holt, a Democrat from New Jersey, chairman of the House Select Intelligence Oversight Panel, joining us from his district office in West Windsor, New Jersey. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Eliza. Eliza with us from Jamaica Plain in Massachusetts.
Hi there. I'm a clinical social worker, and I am curious about the circumstances under which this man's therapist testified about his psychological state and his level of dangerousness, and for that matter, if she thought he was so dangerous, why wasn't he put in the hospital sooner?
David, what do you know about that?
I don't know the legal details, but she had talked to the she was treating him both individually and in group sessions for about 6 months. She says that he showed up making threats, you know, and laying out an elaborate plan for killing people he worked with, but it's clear she also talked to the FBI. So, and then she goes to the court and asks for a restraining order, and when she talks to the judge, it's unclear how much she's saying is from her own experience and how much are things that the FBI told her about analysis they might have done of him psychologically or things they had determined by looking back into his medical record. So things are a little fuzzy there.
Eliza, at some point, if you're a therapist and you believe your client is a danger to him or herself or to others, isn't there an obligation to break confidentiality?
Yeah, and to get the person treatment. I mean, usually they would be seen in the emergency room and possibly hospitalized psychiatrically if they were in imminent danger to somebody or if they were having elaborate plans.
Well, she says that I
wouldn't be able to contain that necessarily doing outpatient therapy. Yeah.
No, she says that she then, after he did that, she contacted his lawyers and they hadn't committed and there was a series of figuring out what to do with him in the hospital.
And medication and that sort of thing, yeah.
I see. I mean, it's just also concerning when, you know, your average citizen hears that a therapist was testifying in court or the circumstances under which she broke confidentiality, and I think it can lead people to feel like their relationship with their therapist is not necessarily confidential. And
that's a good point, Eliza.
It's just not clear what the circumstances were where she was divulging things about his mental health and whether that was sort of kosher.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Eliza. We're talking with NPR science correspondent David Kestenbaum about the case against Dr. Bruce Ivins, the man believed to be the anthrax killer. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Leo. Leo with us from Beverly in Massachusetts.
Is it true that Mr. Ivins passed a lie detector exam, and does this raise questions about him as the lone suspect in the case?
No mention of a lie detector test in the affidavit that was released yesterday, David.
No, but we've reported that he did pass a lie detector test, according to...
How is that possible?
Well, you know, lie detector tests, there's a whole long history of people looking at the science of those and how accurate they are, and... They're not always perfect.
Yeah.
And we were told that Stephen Hatfield failed a lie detector test. So, and it turns out that he was not necessarily the...
As I recall now, actually, by his testimony, he said he took two and he said he passed both of them. But there were stories out there that he had not.
That he had not. Again, yeah. There are a lot of stories out there that were, as the congressman said, not corrected by the FBI during the course of its investigation. So maybe I got that wrong. Leo, thanks very much for the phone call. But these calls about Ivins, they raise questions about who this man was and about the dual life he apparently led.
They had there was a memorial service for him at the lab where he worked yesterday, and you know, everybody there. We were not allowed in, but talking to people who were there, they just told stories of the sort of wonderful, helpful scientist they knew with a quirky sense of humor.
A man who was a mentor to
a mentor and a good scientist. There was one former colleague of his I talked to who said that. You know, Bruce Ivins played music in the church and played the piano or the keyboards. And when this guy's daughter was in musicals and they would walk in the church, Bruce Ivins would notice that they'd walked in and he would play a song from the musical that his daughter was in, just as sort of a quiet hello that she'd entered the church. And, you know, there were a lot of sweet little stories like that about things that he had done. So I think that is why, you know, even today, you know, his friends, they didn't see any of his, you know, how upset he was mentally, and they really can't see that he was the person who sent the letters.
And this also reminds us of the context of these attacks. These started September 2001, right after the attacks of 9/11. And of course, people remember New York and Pennsylvania, but of course, the Pentagon was hit too, the White House believed to be a target.
Right. I mean, this was, you know, sort of overshadowed a bit, I guess, by September 11th, but it really did send the U.S. off on in a slightly different direction. I mean, biodefense was not a big issue. And after this, you know, billions of dollars were spent on biodefense, on trying to develop new vaccines, on detectors, on putting up detectors in the mail system. Just cleaning up the mail system was a major ordeal. Cleaning just the buildings on Capitol Hill, they had to fumigate, you know, multiple times and go in and they'd swab and they'd find another spore. I mean, it was especially in that time of fear, it was a big deal.
And five people killed. Many others, though, got sick. And some of them say they continue to suffer. They continue to suffer from that attack.
There's still debate about that. Yeah, there are people who still say they have these unexplained symptoms that they attribute to being exposed to anthrax.
And some of them have filed lawsuits against the government for what they claim is negligence and its failure to protect them properly. Might this case be tested in those courts.
There's also another case that reminds me of, I think, by the Stevens family in Florida, the first the man to die in these attacks.
In Boca Raton.
Yeah, saying, you know, this, the government, this, if this came out of a government lab, the government, we think, did not do their job in protecting the rest of the public from it. And we'll have to see what happens with those cases.
David Kestenbaum, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. David Kestenbaum, NPR science correspondent, here with us in Studio 3A. You can read more of the details of this case on our website at npr.org. The entire affidavit released by the government yesterday is available there. And, of course, there'll be much more later today on this from NPR News. Coming up, though, on Talk of the Nation, Murray Horowitz and the Summer Movie Festival is back this week. Your favorite wedding movies. Join us for the agony, the ecstasy, and the occasional felony. You don't have to wear white. 800-989-8255 is our phone number. Call us with your favorite wedding movie or send us an email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.